fellow and tutor in economics here at Oxford at Jesus College between the years 1970 and 2000. After that, he was the very first head of the Division of Social Sciences in our university up through 2005. He has, he has conducted economic research in many countries across the world, including in Brazil, in China, and the UK, focusing on empirical research in industrial economics. He's published widely, including the genre of textbooks, and a work called Economics Today, A Christian Critique. More recently in this field, he's worked on topics as diverse as climate change and the economics of marriage and divorce. And he's particularly interested in the relationship between his field of economics and the sort of sociality of a Christian community. Today he will be speaking to us on Seeking the Shalom of the University. So please join me in giving a warm welcome to our speaker, Professor Brian Cox.
Thank you very much, Jimmy. Well, congratulations to you all for surviving until the seventh week of the return, which I seem to remember is about the lowest point of the university year. I think actually 6th week is the worst, because then you've still got 2 to go. By the time you get to 7th week, hope is in sight that you know the term is getting open. So anyway, it's lovely to see you here this evening. And let me tell you what I'm hoping to talk about. What I want to do is to, I'm going to focus on quite a narrow topic, and that is simply, the easiest way of explaining it is that it's the thinking that lay behind the setting up of the Developing Christian Mind program. And I hope it'll become a bit clearer as we get towards that. But I want to begin by drawing your attention to this this concept of seeking the shalom of the city, which appears very strongly in Jeremiah 29, and we'll look at that, but it also reappears in the New Testament in 1 Peter. I then want to go back to what is a very old taxonomy of the interaction between, or the Christian interaction between Christ and culture. A taxonomy which was produced by Richard Niebuhr, just to consider a number of models of the ways in which we might engage with the university. And then I'll talk a bit about, as it were, the thinking behind the Developing the Christian Mind program. So let's start off then with the seeking the shalom of the city. Now, Jeremiah 29:1-7, I won't read it to you. Well, I have a problem here, which is the light is very bad. If I desperately need to read something, I take out my wind-up torch. This provides me with some. The only trouble is, after a little while, the wind-up torch decides it needs to be wound up again, so you have to have a pause while I wind it up. All right. So let's start off with Jeremiah 29:1-7. What's the context? Well, the people of Judah are in exile, and they're in Babylon. The date is 586 BC. Nebuchadnezzar has come in. He's destroyed much of the city. And in particular, he's taken the leading families, both the royal family, the nobles, and anybody wealthy, and he's taken them off to exile in Babylon. And with them, he's taken anything he lays hands on that's of value. So there they are, sitting in exile. And the question then arises, well, as the people of God, they say, well, how long are we going to be in exile? What's happening here? And in chapter 28, there's a false prophet called Hananiah. And he says, don't worry, chaps, it's all going to be over in a couple of years, 18 months, and you'll be back. And Jeremiah comes in and says, I'm sorry, that's not the case. It's going to be 70 years, it's going to be 3 generations that you're going to be in exile. So that, of course, immediately raises a problem. Here we are in exile, and the question is, well, how do we live? You know, how do we conduct ourselves if we're in exile? And the answer that Jeremiah gives them is in this extraordinary letter that he sends them, and he gives them some extraordinary instructions. Now, here's the point at which the wind-up torch may fly into use. I think it probably's going to have to, because probably else I shan't see it. So he writes this letter to them from Jerusalem, and he says, "This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to all those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and settle down. Plant gardens and eat what they produce." So what's he telling them to do? He said, establish normal life. You're going to be here for some time. Don't presume you're just here temporarily. You're here for a season. So that's interesting. Secondly, he says to them, marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage. In other words, keep the family life going. Go to at least the third generation. So that's pretty interesting. Increase in number, therefore do not decrease. And then he says, also seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Now, peace and prosperity there, there's a single Hebrew word, which is shalom. All right? So that's where my title comes from, seeking the shalom. And finally, maybe even more extraordinarily, Jeremiah says, pray to the Lord for the city, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. Now, it's hard to imagine more astonishing instructions than these. Why are they so astonishing? Well, the first thing is, if you're trying to punish a people of God who have fallen into idolatry and fallen away from God, do you really want to relocate them in a major pagan city? Because Babylon had a very, very strong religious ideology around the pagan god Marduk. It's just not the right place. You know, why not send them to the wilderness or something? Somewhere where they can be kind of separated off. No, God has picked them up and put them in a place where it's not going to be easy for them. The other things we know about Babylon are that it was incredibly wealthy. We know that because the archaeologists have dug up a lot of the buildings and so on from there. But most interestingly, perhaps from our point of view, it was a great centre of learning and the sciences. They actually had one of Marduk's sons, called Nabu or Nebo, actually was the god of the sciences and of knowledge and writing and learning and so on. So this was a place with big intellectual life as well. And the question has to be, well, what on earth did Yahweh think he was up to? What was he doing? It clearly wasn't the best destination. And yet it was obviously intentional because, as Jeremiah says, it was God who carried you into exile. Right? Now you would have thought, well, actually Nebuchadnezzar carried you into exile. And Jeremiah said, no, this was God's intention that you should be taken. But Nebuchadnezzar was simply the instrument. And what Jeremiah is saying is, that's the place I want you to be. God is still with you, and your task is to seek the shalom, the peace and prosperity of this place. Now, exactly the same language is used in 1 Peter. This is actually expounded in this book by Bruce Winter called The Welfare of the City, which I would commend to you. It's a really interesting study, and I think it's been rather neglected. And the let me just read you again, let me just read you a little bit of it so that you can get the flavour of what's going on. So we start off the book, or the letter rather, with Peter, I'm presuming Peter wrote it. He starts off by saying, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to God's elect exiles scattered throughout the provinces of Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, and other places. And then again in chapter 2, verse 11, he says, dear friends, I urge you as foreigners and exiles. And so he's picking up this theme of being exiles. So the language of exile is being used. But more than that, he says, but you remain a chosen people. So chapter 2, verse 9, you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession. And then he goes on to say, once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. So he's identifying again, saying, look, you are God's people. And he tells them that they should have distinctive lifestyles. So he says, abstain from sinful desires and live good lives. And he also warns them that they're going to be subject to a great deal of hostility. So you get to the end of the letter. Let me see if I can find it quickly. He says, yes, in chapter 4, verse 12, dear friends, do not be surprised that the fiery ordeal has come upon you to test you. Rejoice in as much as you participate in the sufferings of Christ. So it was not an easy being kind of exiles in this way. Now, you might say, well, what's this language of exile about? They weren't, of course, literally exiles. But what Peter is saying is, it's as if they were exiles. They're living in the midst of pagan cultures. Now, the really interesting thing is that Peter tells them, and I think I've already read this to you, live such good lives among the pagans, that though they may accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. And again, later on he talks about doing good. And the question is, well, what's that language about? And the answer is that the language, at least according to Bruce Winter, I think he's right on this, is it's actually the language that was used of public benefactors in Greek and Roman cities. Now, who were the public benefactors? Well, public benefactors were very important people in most Greek and Roman cities. Why were they? Because they were the people who paid for the games. They were the people who paid for building public facilities. They were the people who put money into relief for the poor. They were the people who, in a sense, made the thing work. And they were the benefactors. And in return, they received a great deal of respect and recognition. What is Peter saying here? He's saying to the Christians, act as if you were benefactors, and benefactors of these places where you're living. And once more, he's addressing this not to individuals, because most of the benefactors are very rich people who are rich individuals. He's actually saying the whole church should act as if it were a benefactor. He's saying you, as the people of God in this place, are to act as if you were benefactors of these cities. And why should you do this? Because it's part of your demonstration of the truth of the gospel. So I hope I convinced you that this theme of being an exile, but seeking the shalom of the places where you live and work, is very important. That is biblically very important. So the next question is, well, okay, if that's what we're going to do, or we have to do, how do we actually do it? And this is the point at which I'm going to draw your attention to Richard Niebuhr. This is not the famous Reinhold Niebuhr, this is his brother, Richard, okay? And this is a book which goes back to 1951, and is much quoted. Now, what does Niebuhr do? He says, if you look at Christ and culture, that is, relationship between Christian faith and the culture of the societies in which Christians live, there are a number of options. And he comes up with, in fact, a typology of five options. I want to look at three of them. And I want to look at them specifically in the context of how Christians might relate to the university. Okay. So the first of these is what he calls Christ above culture. And the way this might work it out is, I think, typically would be in the United States, we have there are lots and lots of Christian colleges. Right? There are Catholic universities worldwide. And how do these work? Well, one of the ways they work is by ensuring that all the professors actually sign up to the Declaration of Faith or the Confession of Faith of the college. They often aspire to having a genuinely Christian basis for the education that they're providing. And occasionally, they go a little bit beyond that and they'll actually seek to critique secular models or secular understandings. But the model is basically the Christian community retreats into their Christian college, and in their Christian college, they're sort of safe. Now, the second kind of approach which I want to draw your attention to is what's called Christ and culture in paradox. This goes back to Martin Luther and Martin Luther's doctrines of the two kingdoms. So there's the kingdom of God on one side, and then there's the kingdom of the world on the other side. And basically, never the two shall meet. But Christians live in both. All right? So they, as it were, live in the Christian kingdom of the world, but they are also members of the kingdom of God. So the question is, well, how do they conduct themselves in the world? And the answer is, I mean, this is hugely simplistic summary. The answer is they adjust the way in which they live to the norms of the culture of the world in which they live. So what would this mean in terms of relations with the secular university? The answer would be that the Christian academic, or even the Christian student, operates in two worlds. And in particular, they accept the intellectual autonomy of their discipline within the secular university, and then they go to church on Sunday. And they keep those two completely apart. They have a Christian community, and then they have, as it were, the work that they do on a daily basis. But then the third one that I want to draw your attention to is Christ the Transformer of Culture. And I think the best way, this incidentally, according to Niebuhr, and I'm not a theologian, so I don't know, he would say that's been the theological mainstream since Augustine onwards. And basically, what it requires is neither, on the one hand, withdrawal, nor, on the other hand, capitulation. So what you do is you go into the secular university with your Christian faith, and you allow that to, well, what I like is this idea of constructive engagement, which was coined by James Davison Hunter in this really interesting book, To Change the World. So what does it mean? Well, it means as a Christian, you engage constructively with, as it were, the secular thought of the university. Now, I think I need to wind up my torch, so I'm going to get you to talk among yourselves about this question. All right. So I'd like you to turn to somebody near to you and just spend a moment or two asking this question. Which of Niebuhr's three options on Christ and culture, above, in paradox, transformer, is likely to be the most appropriate for the church in interaction with the university? Sorry, most appropriate for Christians, really, in interaction with the university in the 21st century. So I will go back so you can see the three. Just have a moment or two to you. I think you may be now sobbing. Let me just take a straw poll. Who would vote for the one?
I can be devil's advocate and go for that, depending on what you mean by it.
It's gotta be, it has to be part of the story. I mean, to some extent, up to a certain age, your children, and also just the way you still do church and you form in groups like this to encourage one another, there has to be an element or the Christians are together being Christians with each other.
Okay, all right. Who would vote for the second one? Well, what I have to tell you is the vast majority of Christian academics I know actually vote with the second. In other words, they live completely separate lives. And I leave that for you to think about. Who would vote for the third? Well, that's just as well, because that's what I think is the right
answer. Abstaining?
I mean, it is simplistic. I think you're quite right. You say it depends what you mean. But I hope I've given you a kind of a bit of a flavour of these three ways of doing things. Now, I personally am committed to the third. Now, that may be because of my theological background and so on. But it certainly is what was the basis of my thinking, our thinking, as we set up the Christian Life Program. So that's where we're starting from. So we're looking at ways in which we can engage. And basically, I think what sort of motivated me was basically two New Testament key biblical texts in the New Testament. The first one's Mark 12. 28-30. This is the time where the teacher of the law comes to Jesus and says, "What's the greatest commandment?" And Jesus replies with the Shema. That was the statement from, let me just check it, Deuteronomy 6:14, which every pious Jew would have actually said morning and evening at least, which is, "You should love the Lord your God with heart, soul, mind, and strength." Except that the word mind is inserted. That's not in the Deuteronomy passage. Now, what's happening there? What's the word for mind? Well, the word for mind is about our cognitive and rational capacities. And Jesus brings that in. And I think what he's saying is, look, I mean, I think the Hebrew concept was the whole person, all right? But in the context in which Jesus was speaking, it was important to include the word for the life of the mind as part of the whole person. Right? But the mind is very clearly there. It means the cognitive aspect. It means thinking rationally about things. The other text, which I always found extremely challenging, was that in Romans 12:1-2, where Paul, having gone through his 11 chapters of Christian doctrine, and the doctrine of the cross and so on, he suddenly says, "Therefore, be renewed in your minds. Be transformed in the renewing of your mind." And again, the word there is that for rational thought. And it, in the context, it's very clear that what Paul has in mind is actually kind of ethical living, thinking about the ways in which we live ethically in the world. Because his illustrations are ethical rather than intellectual. Now, I personally found myself enormously challenged by these two texts. And the first question is simply, looking at the first one, what does it mean if you're an academic or an academic institution to love the Lord your God with all your mind? What does it actually mean? And what I came up with is that the challenges which a Christian faces are not primarily those which are produced by the new atheists. They're actually at the core of our disciplines. This is the shocking thing. You discover that at the core of your discipline, there are presuppositions which as Christians you shouldn't be doing. So, what kind of presuppositions may they be? Well, certainly in some areas of the social sciences, it's naturalism. Human beings are basically jumped up animals, very complex, highly intelligent, do all sorts of things, but they are animals. That's basically it. They have to be rather superior animals. There's no real difference between being a great ape and being a human being. It's just, I mean, the DNA is more or less the same. It's just the kind of a bit of sophistication. Yeah. So that's one challenge. Another challenge is basically scientism. That is, the only way to know anything true is through scientific method. And if something cannot be scientifically demonstrated, then it's untrue, or at least you should take no notice of it. And it may be metaphysics or something terrible. So that's one thing. The third area is actually the concept of truth. I don't know what your disciplines are like, but I can tell you about economics, which is, some time ago, it stopped worrying about whether something was true or not. Or that's perhaps a little bit too dismissive. Their concept of truth ended up as more or less whatever works. And the idea that you really wanted in your studies to find out the truth about something. Now, I know nothing about the humanities, and I know nothing about postmodernism, but I understand that in the humanities this is a very serious issue, because truth is an incredibly slippery concept. And then the other area where I certainly felt quite heavily challenged was values and ethics, which is the kind of the Romans 12:1-2 thing. And in particular, in some disciplines at least, indeed in my own discipline, there is a direct attack on the Christian understanding of what makes a human flourishing. Right? Now, it's implicit. It's not that every economist stands up and says, I disagree with the Christian faith. But the model of human flourishing that you have in economics is not the Christian understanding of human flourishing. And you need to bear that in mind. The other thing which, again, and I'm sorry, just talking from what the subjects I know about, the incredibly strong hold that utilitarianism has got in the social and economic sciences, but I think more widely. And the third thing is this very strongly prevailing view, particularly from those who study culture, and the anthropologists and so on, which is anything is okay, anything goes. And the idea that you should not in any sense bring a sense of moral judgment if you're studying a society or literature or history or whatever it is, that's not part of the agenda. So what I want to get home to you is, when I'm thinking about engaging with the university, I'm asking you to engage with the intellectual foundations of your disciplines. All right? I'm not talking about the university as a human institution. We could talk about that later if you really want me to, because I know a bit about that too. But what I really want to get across to you is, these are institutions whose intellectual foundations should, in my view, raise all sorts of queries for both the Christian student and the Christian academic. And I think I'd just like you to have a quick interaction with that, if I may. So, what do you think of the main intellectual and ethical challenges for Christians within their academic discipline? And do you feel well prepared to defend your faith in those challenges? So, not only is the torch wound up, but your speaker is also wound up, so I should be able to keep going till the end now. I presume that you have begun to identify places where you feel well confident. I'd be a bit surprised if you didn't. The only person who's ever been able to say to me, having thought about it hard, was somebody who was doing a DPhil in such pure mathematics that he was about one of the only three people in the world who understood what he was doing. I did sort of feel a bit sympathetic with him. But most other folk, I think if you push disciplines hard enough, if you press hard enough, you begin to find places where people can feel a bit uncomfortable about what's being said and done. So anyway, that's over to you. So what are we going to do about it? How do we, as Christians, engage constructively? And the first step is one which you may not wish to hear. The first step is that you have to gain an understanding of Christian faith as and Christian theology as a worldview which is an intellectual worldview. So it's not just faith, but for you folk, it's also a complete way of thinking about the world. And that's something which you have to work at. Because if you don't have that intellectual firepower from the point of view of your faith, I can tell you, you will be defeated every single time by the intellectual firepower of your discipline, particularly in a place like this. So you need to, as it were, build your intellectual firepower on the basis of your faith. Now, that actually, if you came to the first DCM conference, that's what it's all about. You may not have picked up on it. I love this diagram. Why do I love it? Because actually, I think this diagram encapsulates all the key things about Christian doctrine that we need to put in place. We obviously have to build an awful lot of substructure, but this is the substructure. You have to build a lot of material. So what does this say? It says, actually, the Christian worldview essentially says that our understanding of the world is made up of the relationships between God, humanity, God and the natural order, and humanity and the natural order. It's very, very simple. Let me just spell it out. Okay, so what's the relationship between God and the natural order? Well, the answer is God is the creator and sustainer of the natural order. All right. And why does that matter? Well, it matters simply because he's made it intelligible, and he's made it purposeful, and he's given it value. That's essentially what that bit of doctrine is about. Secondly, the second key relationship, you might be surprised, is between God and humanity. So what lies at the core of that? First of all, of course, the fact that we're made in the image of God. And out of that, and that of course is something you should need to unpack, but out of that also comes the fact that because God is triune, we are made inescapably social. So we're not individuals, which of course is the great, if you like, the great post-Enlightenment heresy. We're not primarily individuals. We're both individuals, but individuals in relationship. Okay. And then the third relationship is between humanity and the natural order. Why are we here? We're put on Earth to work with the natural order, to provide for human flourishing, and to care for God's created order. That's what we're here for. That's our task. That's what Genesis 1 to 3 is all about. Okay. Now, of course, there's a lot more to be said. That's as it should be, but actually, of course, we're fallen. What does that mean? Well, it means that that relationship between God and humanity is ruptured, and is ruptured. Okay. And that then has consequences for all the other relationships, except the one between God and natural order. He still sustains the natural order. But it has serious consequences for our relationships among ourselves, so that instead of love and service, relationships are characterized by the exercise of power and taking. Relationship to humanity and the natural order, do I have to mention climate change? You know, that's a beautiful illustration of how we are actually destroying what we were meant to care for, and so on. So there's a lot more that I could put in here. And of course, I haven't yet got on to dealing with salvation and the people of God, nor have I dealt with eschatology, but perhaps for a moment or two. Now, I'm not going to make you discuss this thing, but I just want you to read it and think about it for about 30 seconds. Okay. So once we've developed...
Could you go back just for the quick second?
I beg your pardon.
Sorry. Thank you.
Actually, we can leave this on, people can have access to it. Is there some way that can be done?
Yeah, I think we can do it on the website. That would
yeah,
be wonderful
website.
If you don't mind.
No, that's fine. I think it's got my name on it.
Wait.
Maybe I should take my name off.
You should add your phone number.
When you say understand your Christian faith, are you referring to theology or are you referring to something else? What,
okay.
You just...
Well, I don't think you could really understand Christian faith unless you do theology. In this context, right? Now, there are plenty of people out there who are wonderful Christians who live their lives, love other people, serve their neighbours, do all sorts of great things in the world. There are plenty of those. And they don't have to have a developed theology. But you do. Because if you don't, you will never be able to, in fact, bring your Christian understanding to bear on the problems of medicine.
Are we in discussion time now?
No, we're out of discussion. I've nearly finished, actually.
Okay, so
we
should
take
lots of questions,
questions
at the end.
Yeah,
okay.
I think one of the things that's really shocked me over the time I've been in Oxford, I've been here far too long, approximately 50 years, is how many really intelligent Christians I know who work at the university, whose faith is still at, in English terms, maximum A level. Right? In other words, they have never really developed a deep understanding of their faith in any systematic way. Now, that may sound very harsh, but I have to tell you, that's my experience. That people do not, Christians do not put in the time and the energy of the application as necessary to develop their understanding of Christian faith in a way which will enable them to really grapple with the intellectual problems, which may sound often thrown out. I don't think I'm exaggerating, but I think that really is the case. There are wonderful exceptions, but on the whole, people don't see their Christian life. They see it as commitment to a group of people in a church context. They see it in terms of service. They see it maybe in terms of buying into particular sets of ethics and ethical values and so on. What they don't actually see it as is a way of thinking about the world generally. But that's where a new problem comes up. They have no, they never went to. They never went to. Anyway, let me finish on because I can see you're getting restive. And so, if you hold a Christian worldview, and I mean, let me say immediately, I am skating over all sorts of issues because I just want to give you a kind of conspectus of what I think, certainly, I've been up to with the Christian mind. The first question we need to ask within a Christian worldview is how do we know things? And most importantly, how do we set about the pursuit of truth? And I think the two points here are this. The first is God made the world ordered and purposeful. That's very important. And because he did, I think that makes natural science possible. It makes social science possible, though sometimes messed up by human sinfulness. Okay? So you have problems like that. But I suppose the point which I really want to make is, as Christians, we should be devoted to seeking the truth about what's out there. Why? Because we have a God who believes in truth, and so should we. And I think that immediately gets rid of the kind of anything goes approach to intellectual disciplines. If it's really clever, it's okay, even if it happens to be 1,000 miles from the truth. So what we're interested in is intellectual firepower, not in truth. At least that's the impression. Now, your disciplines may be wonderful. They may be full of people seeking for truth, real truth. All right. But I can tell you, my discipline is not like that at all. intellectual firepower in economics has very little to do with truth. It has to do with enormous technical cleverness. Okay. Those are the people who get the Nobel Prizes. Okay. Right. And then the second question, which I think a Christian worldview has to raise, is simply this. How should we evaluate? What ethical values are implicit in the way our discipline is pursued and deployed? Why do ethical norms, why do ethical values make, why are they important? Well, because despite all the jokes about us being in an ivory tower, there's one thing that actually being in Oxford 50 years has taught me is that ideas have legs. Right? And ideas very quickly move out of the university into all sorts of places, particularly if they're promoted by very clever people. Right? So the idea somehow, it really doesn't matter ethically what we're doing, because we're kind of closed. You know, we only speak to each other. The answer is that's not true. Our ideas go out into the world and they have some big effects. I could talk a bit more about that. But let me just give you one example. Some years back, I better not say how years back, I had a colleague who was a very distinguished laser physicist. And he was very good at lasers. But a very large part of his laser research program was financed by the US Office of Naval Research. And over lunch one day, I and somebody else sort of said to him, did he have any qualms about that? He said, no, why should I? I said, well, it's pretty clear that they're interested in lasers because they're interested in laser-guided missiles, bombs. In other words, they're interested in the weapons application. And he said, that's no concern of mine. They pay me the fee to do the research, and what they do with them is their concern. I don't think we can live like that. And that's just a very encapsulated for me the sense that ideas have legs. In other words, you do research here, and suddenly it's spreading around outside, and you have no control over it. Now, he could have sat down and said, hang on a minute, I think I have a counter to argue. I'm supporting the US Office of Naval Research because I believe in the free world, and I believe that supporting the defense of the free world, and so on. He could have constructed an argument, but he didn't, just simply say, there's no concern. And I don't think that's good. And I still don't think that's good. Okay, I've talked for long enough. Let me just conclude. I am convinced that we need to seek the shalom of the university intellectually. We have to have a model of constructive engagement. We can't live in separate worlds. And I think that constructive engagement as Christians means we have to engage with the intellectual foundations and structures of our disciplines. We can't do that unless we have a well-worked-out model of theological understanding of our faith. And I think we have to be alert or ready to engage with questions of truth, whether that be in epistemology or it be with our own values. So there you are. You've had your study, I've just reflected on actually almost 50 years as an undergrad. Over to you.
Thank you so much, right. Professor Kay, for an inspiring and convicting, thought-provoking talk. Are you willing to field some
yes,
questions?
Of course. Yes, that's okay. Fine. But you had a question, so you should start.
Oh, no. As president, I don't let myself start.
Do you not?
But
even
I will...
if I invite you.
My question's rather long and intricate, so I will let some other people
okay.
begin,
all right.
and we
okay.
may lead into it eventually. But I very much hope to be able to speak with you about this.
Okay. All right. Fine. Okay.
Are you comfortable? Would you like me to sit here and field questions? Or
well, are they very sloppy?
Well, sometimes they can get a little.
Do they? Well, then you better organize.
Okay.
That's wrong.
All right. Does anyone have a question? Or a thought. One of the things that I love about GCF is it can be pushback, it can be disagreement, it can be cheerleading, it can be your favorite quote from a poem that synthesizes his talk. However you would like to participate in the discussion.
So thank you so much. I have a question about how this ties into openness through faith, as well as how far along you are in your career, because I've heard some other Christian academics have talked about kind of this idea of do your work and do it really well and be very quiet about what you believe until you've reached academic credibility, and then you have the opportunity to be more open and to be more effective, but that's not something that is tenable at your own stages of career, and I wonder what you thought about that or your own experience with that.
Okay, I'll tell you what my experience was. Whether it would be possible to do that now, I'm not sure. Right from the very beginning, when I... That'd be great, thank you. Right from the very beginning, when I took up my first appointment, I committed myself to spending roughly 20-25% of my research time looking at this issue of engagement. And sometimes it was more than that, and sometimes it was a lot less. Thanks very much. Could I get away with that now? I think probably not. I mean, the atmosphere of the university has changed enormously over that time. Some of you may have heard this story, so I have yours. Go see. I suppose it must be the 1990s, the universities in this country started to be afflicted by something called the research assessment exercise, or the research evaluation framework, or something, which is a national evaluative framework. And it's important to the universities because a lot of funding depends on it, research funding depends on it. And the first time it happened, I think it was the first time, a little group was formed in the Department of Economics, and they sent round a thing saying everybody should submit a list of things they've published in the past 5 years. And so everybody sent a list of things they've published in the past 5 years. And then this little group were allowed to choose 4 items, which then went on to the department of submission to this national exercise. And when the list came back for checking, to my utter astonishment, they had listed out of my 4, they'd listed 2 of my Christian publications. And I thought quite hard about that. And I said, I rang up the chap who's in the chair of this group, and I said, do you know what you're doing? Why have you listed these things rather than my Beihan academic work? But he said, well, I'll tell you the truth, he said. To begin with, we did this thing. And then we looked at the whole set of publications right across the department. And we thought it was incredibly boring, because it was all the same. And so we looked around for things which looked a bit different. And he said, two of your Christian things look so different that we thought we'd put them in to, as it were, act as kind of leaven in the lump. So, two things can happen. I suppose the truth of the matter was I had to work much harder than everybody else, because I had to produce all the articles I was supposed to produce as and when my mainstream partners. So the other had to be done not exactly my spare time, but it had to be kind of additional. If there'd been any sense that I wasn't publishing, you know, in the mainstream journals and so on, then there would have been trouble, I think. I suppose the other thing that was on my side is I did it right at the very beginning. And so they kind of got used to the fact that I was an odd boy, basically. But in fact, I think that's a bit unkind to them, actually, because I think after a while they respected it. They said, this guy is different. He does things differently. He writes about things we wouldn't write about. And I don't think they treated me as an odd boy. Maybe they did. Maybe I was sort of... You know. Now, having said all that, I'm as it were, reporting on my experience. Now, the question is, what would happen if you tried to do it now? And the answer is, well, when I was appointed in 1970, one of the great things about Oxford is you could do exactly what you want. There was no professor hanging over you saying, why don't you publish it? Why haven't you brought in this research grant? And so it just didn't work like that. It was much more a community of scholars, and everybody was expected to contribute, and they did. It was a very different kind of atmosphere. Now, what I would advise you to do, if you're embarking on an academic career, is start small, but always have that Christian presence in your research. Always have a project which you're working on, which is to do with the integration of faith and faith. If you do that, it will remind you when you're doing your mainline work, your mainstream work, that you are a Christian. And really you should be thinking Christianly about all your work. And you may not be able to, as it would, do that explicitly, but it will begin to affect the way in which you do work. As your reputation grows, and I hope it will, then the point will come where you can, as it were, come out. So, you know, you could write a book. I wrote a book on Christian faith and economy, published in 1989. Right? And it raised some eyebrows around the place. I actually had a party to launch this book and invited them to it. And they were pretty surprised. But I didn't get any kickback. And I think my proudest moment. Am I allowed to tell you about my proudest moment?
Please.
Is that right?
We love the personal stories.
Yeah, there's a Nobel Prize winner in economics called Amartya Sen, who many, many people have heard of. Very, very distinguished. His origin is Indian, but he's a kind of international citizen. And he is the loveliest person. But he is an atheist, except he's a Hindu atheist. That's where it comes from. He was in Oxford for a while. He was one of the lead professors of economics. And he was around at the time I published this book. And because I quoted him at various places, I gave him a copy of the book. And he said, thank you, as he would be very polite. And I heard nothing. And then he then moved to Harvard. And out of the blue, I had a letter from him. And the letter started off by saying, I was recovering from a bout of malaria. And poor chap, he seemed to get bouts of malaria fairly regularly. And he said, I chanced upon your book and started to read it. And he said, I haven't read it all, but I've read quite a lot of it. And he said, I want you to know, you do know that I'm an atheist, but I want you to know that I thought it was an extremely interesting exercise. So, that's my moment of pride. Mm-hmm. Nobel Prize winner Patty Young here said, well done. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know, that's... I think the thing that you mustn't do is start off your career by saying, I can't do it because it will do me damage. But I do think I had to work much harder than some of my colleagues. And I probably didn't get the kind of promotions which other people would get. But
But it's worth it. That's good. Time for your long question, I think.
No, I don't. I think Carl had a question.
What was your question?
Should we have handled it, Carl?
What was that?
Oh, never mind.
So you talked about ideas have legs. And so I wondered if you thought that we have even a duty to sort of share Christian knowledge with the public. And alongside that, I wondered if you have sort of any general thoughts about sort of recent kind of trend or expectations maybe around, you know, so-called public outreach and these kinds of projects that are often, I think, academics are expected to do, or seem to be increasingly expected to do, where they actually sort of make research available to the public.
Right.
Yeah, so I wondered, if you think there's a duty to do that, and then if so, how might be some effective mediums for that, and then also this question of, you know, how effective is